This hour of the Jason Rancho is brought to you by PRMI, Primary Residential Mortgage. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? National.
President Trump left the White House early this morning around 8 a.m. Eastern time. But before he left for his home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, he gave a final speech to a group of supporters. And what's frustrating is that it yet once again was a near perfect speech that we're not going to have him be able to deliver again. Unless, of course, he runs in 2024. And what's frustrating is as he delivers this great speech, it gets immediately attacked over at CNN. I purposely put on CNN because I wanted to see how they would react, because they have to realize that they are, at that point, they were 10, 15, 20 minutes away from losing Donald Trump as a daily punching bag. And I have to assume that they're all going through some soul searching to figure out how they're going to grift in the future, how they're going to recover from the shameful display of partisan hackery that they were involved with for the last 4 years. And I have to assume someone like a Jake Tapper, who used to be respected and now is just a clown, he's going to have to figure out, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? So the president offered his goodbye message earlier this morning.
I will always fight for you. I will be watching. I will be listening. And I will tell you that the future of this country has never been better. I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success. They have the foundation to do something really spectacular. And again, we put it in a position like it's never been before, despite the worst plague to hit since, I guess you'd say, 1917, over 100 years ago. And despite that, the things that we've done have been just incredible. And I couldn't have done it without you. So just a goodbye. We love you. We will be back in some form.
Now, what that form looks like, I don't know. We don't know yet. The truth of the matter is, he relied on Twitter to get messages out. And they've taken that away from him. I don't know when he'll be back officially on Facebook and YouTube and everything else that big tech decided to take away from him. But you could tell from the speech, and this was the first time I've seen this emotion from him, he was sad. He was sad to leave the White House, a position that I know Democrats, when he was running, kept claiming he doesn't even want to be president. He was surprised when he got the nomination. He's going to sandbag it so he loses. He doesn't want it. He very clearly does. And I believe that he cares not just about this country in general, but specifically about the people who are part of his movement. The folks who live in the heartland, the folks that Democrats look at with disdain in some regard and look down at in other regards. The truth of the matter is, Democrats as a party, the Democratic Party, seems to care more about the big city urban residents of a Seattle, the urban centers, LA, New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, Portland. That's what they care about. They don't care about, or at least don't try to even come off as caring about, folks who live outside of these big city centers. You know, we talk about, for example, Congresswoman Kim Schreier, who represents Auburn. I don't think she knows where it is. I don't think you'll ever find her in Enumclaw. I don't think that Democrats care enough to connect with those folks, because they realize that all they need to stay in power are the ones who live in the big city centers, the urban cores of these cities. And part of the reason why so many folks in smaller and mid-sized communities and cities and towns all over the country supported Donald Trump and to this day are so loyal to him is because he spoke to them directly. And of all the people who you would expect to be condescending towards that community, it would probably be a Donald Trump, someone who is wealthy, a businessman from New York. And yet that's not what he did at all. And thanks to his support, he was able not just to get into the White House, but he was able to do so much.
What we've done has been amazing by any standard. We rebuilt the United States military. We created a new force called Space Force. That in itself would be a major achievement for a regular administration. We were not a regular administration.
No, they weren't. And he, of course, went on to detail so much more of his policy wins, whether it comes to creating a strong economy, getting us out of some wars. He listed his achievements, and apparently that was something that is verboten, I guess, because when you tune into CNN, Jake Tapper afterwards was just taken aback at how the president, who in his farewell speech was reflecting on the previous 4 years, talked about himself too much. That's literally a criticism that you heard on CNN. That the president, in a farewell speech, reflecting on his time in office, spent too much time talking about himself. Unlike, of course, Barack Obama, who never would do that. Except he literally always did that. But when Donald Trump does it, they can't help but express their disdain. You had Wolf Blitzer say this as Trump got onto the helicopter to take him off towards Joint Base Andrews for that
speech. What a difference 4 years makes. He had a very impressive, huge crowd at his inauguration. It's going to be a little pathetic, a tiny little crowd at Joint Base Andrews where he's going to say goodbye.
A little tiny pathetic. Uh-huh. Okay. It could be the biggest crowd in the world. You won't show all the people in that crowd. Then, of course, Jim Acosta on his last breath as a White House correspondent.
This is looking like, a president or a foreign head of state leaving Washington. Because the president is defying these traditions of not being a part of the inauguration of President Joe Biden, he's almost leaving town like an autocrat, ousted from power, heading off into exile. One thing I can tell you, talking to advisors, is that the president was hoping to have a big crowd here this morning. I can tell you right now, there isn't any crowd at this point.
Yeah, okay. There first of all, was a crowd. But I love the idea that Jim Acosta, this dum-dum, will call out Donald Trump leaving office as almost like an autocrat. Uh-huh. Like, it's almost indicative of Jim Acosta not knowing what that word actually means, which, of course, wouldn't surprise any of us. As I was watching some of the coverage, I was wondering, what does CNN do for the next 4 years? They decided to completely get rid of their normal brand as a straight news network. It always leaned a little bit to the left, but they never were abject partisans the way that they were under Donald Trump. And they tried to compete essentially with MSNBC for that, and MSNBC does it much better. Because they're at least smart on MSNBC. Not all of them. Joy Reid's an idiot. Chris Hayes wants you to believe he's smart. But Rachel Maddow is smart. I disagree with her, but she's smart. You've got smarter people on MSNBC who are at least not pretending that they're anything but left-wing activists. Whereas on CNN, they pretend that this is, oh, we're just being honest. What do they do for the next 4 years? They can't fawn over Joe Biden for the next 4 years because that's what MSNBC is going to do. And again, they'll be better at that. We'll find out. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. 1-800-465-8770. I'd love for you to weigh in. When we come back, we're going to stick with Drew Stokesbury. He's going to stop by. He's going to give us an update on where he's headed with a new economic recovery package that he's introduced in Olympia. Does it have a shot? How will it help our economy as we are continuing to deal with COVID? He's going to explain when we come back. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
Congressman, I almost gave him an upgrade. Representative Drew Stokesbury is the Republican from Auburn who just introduced a $4 billion economic recovery package that is supposed to help our COVID economy here in Washington State. It's called the Real Recovery for Washington Act. And it would give a whole bunch of financial support to families and businesses that right now are struggling. It would help us reopen our schools safely. And it would expand COVID testing and vaccine administration, both of which desperately need some help thanks to the mismanagement of the Inslee administration. Joining us on the line, State Representative Stokesbury. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason.
So how would the money be used? Take us through some of the details.
Yeah, well, you gave a really great summary, but I think the best way to conceptualize it is that these funds would help three broad groups of people. The first is it would help families that need help right now. Second, it would help students who need our help. And lastly, it would help businesses who need our help. When it comes to families, there is some money to provide a sales tax rebate to working families. It's based off of the federal earned income tax credit. There is rental assistance money for folks who are struggling with making ends meet to pay their rent because they've experienced some of the effects of coronavirus, whether they've gotten sick themselves or have lost their job because their business shut down. There is $300 per student who qualifies for a free and reduced lunch to help their families defray the cost of remote learning, whether that means buying faster broadband or an extra device or just making ends meet because somebody gets to work fewer hours at work because they've got to be home with the kids more. When it comes to students, like you mentioned, one of the big goals here is to get schools open back up. The federal government provided over $800 million in school funding in their COVID relief package they passed last December. And so this bill would say that schools only begin to get that money once they have a plan for reopening, and when they have a plan to reopen, they get half of the money, and when they actually reopen, they get the other half, and then they can use that money to help make sure it's a safe environment. It also funds one of the only good ideas the governor had in his budget, which is to help provide additional instruction to kids who have fallen behind because they don't learn as well on a computer as they do in person. And while I think that's a problem largely of the governor's own making, doesn't mean we shouldn't also try to solve it. And then, as you and your listeners know, there's a lot of businesses out there struggling. Too many have closed their doors already. All of them who have employees are going to be hit with a massive unemployment tax rate increase. So this bill would really, really blunt the impact of that. It would actually reduce the B&O tax rate temporarily for the businesses, for the industries that have been hardest hit. And it would expand the grant program to help businesses that have been ordered to be closed cover those fixed costs that they incur even when their doors are closed, like rent or debt service payments or something like that.
So obviously, when we're talking about $4 billion, that's a lot of money. Where is the money coming from?
So great question. About half of the money comes from the state's rainy day fund. The other half comes from money that the federal government already sent us. So that money was already spent by the feds one way or the other, and it's now up to the state to kind of administer it. But the money that comes from our rainy day fund, that's a question that I've been telling my constituents about and fellow Republicans about. As fiscal conservatives, we take seriously our responsibility to safeguard and be good stewards of taxpayer dollars, and especially when it comes to the rainy day fund, which is basically our state's savings account. But if there was ever a time to use the rainy day fund, it is now. I mean, it is absolutely pouring for some families. I have trouble imagining a scenario where people need more help than they do right now. I also think that because this is savings account money that you can really only access one time, it's not like a revenue stream where we get the same dollar amount every year, we should really only spend that money on expenses that occur only one time. And the governor's plan, the budget he submitted to the legislature, takes the entire amount out of the rainy day fund, and he just uses it to fund his budget, including a bunch of new programs that he's going to have to pay for this year and next year and every year after that. I don't think that's very good budgeting. And so if the money is going to be spent, I think we should spend it on a bunch of things that we only have to pay for once. And everything in this bill, and the bill I'm proposing, the Real Recovery Act, are one-time expenses. And so I actually think it's a really responsible way to spend this money, because it's there for a reason, and this is the reason. And it doesn't obligate us to pay future expenses, so it won't kick the can down the road.
State Representative Drew Stokesbury joining us on the line, Republican from Auburn, to promote the Real Recovery for Washington Act. It's House Bill 1334. So if this is something you want to get behind, and I encourage you to do so, make sure that you're calling your state representative and urging them to support 1334. I do have a question as far as, you know, to the point of the $4 billion, and I get it that you want to do this once, and I think that is the responsible way to do things. If we were to go into phase two as of tomorrow, even though that's not reasonable, but the bill got its first hearing today, that if it actually gets a vote and goes through the process, we can get to phase two relatively quickly, which means some businesses that are currently completely shut down for the most part, like gyms or restaurants, go to 25%. Would we still need $4 billion in your budget?
You know, I think that we definitely would need some of it, but perhaps not all of it. And the bill is actually designed to address some of those things. And this is actually another question that I've gotten a few times already, so I appreciate it. This bill is by no means the only way to help our economy recover. I think it's a necessary component, but it's far from a sufficient component. Another necessary component is what you said. We've got to get things open back up. I mean, that's the common sense approach. But, you know, the reality is, whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, that the governor is not allowing that. I've got some deep disagreements with that. I helped take him to court over the summer to challenge the constitutionality of some of the things he was doing. But we're not at the point where the governor is opening us back up yet. There's a lot of folks in the legislature, myself included, that are fighting for that. But in the meantime, just because one arm of the state is making life difficult doesn't mean that the other arm of the state shouldn't be reaching out, trying to help people. And that's what this bill does. We're still going to try to work on the other arm to make sure it's not keeping people down. But in the meantime, I think it's appropriate to use this other arm, the budgetary arm, and try to help people up. And if everything opens back up in the next month, then, yeah, I don't think we'll need to drive out as much money in rental assistance or small business grants. But that doesn't mean that people don't need that help right now just to pay their bills to get through the rest of the month.
And just real quickly, because, you know, you're pointing out that people are struggling. Democrats are pushing with a new gas tax. At the same time, we're, you know, seeing them push a cap and trade tax, all these other deals. And I know that you're critical of all of that, especially now. Just 30 seconds. How do Republicans do a better job of getting word out to let them know that this is right now what Democrats are talking about? Because I can't imagine there is any broad support for an increase in gas taxes right now.
Yeah, you know, I think it just is incumbent upon folks like you and me and your listeners to talk to everybody we know to make sure they understand what it is state Democrats are proposing in Olympia. And you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the easiest one to understand is what they announced yesterday, which is a gas tax that would bring our total gas tax up to something like a dollar. And the amount of the gas tax increase proposed yesterday was what, like 20 cents or so? Mm-hmm. It would be by far the biggest single increase of the gas tax in state history. And that's just the direct gas tax. The governor is also proposing, as he has for the past couple of sessions, something called a low-carbon fuel standard, because it's part of his never-ending quest to copy everything that's going wrong in California and import that into Washington. And essentially, it's trying to reduce how much carbon dioxide your gasoline emits when it burns in your engine. But the obvious consequence is it makes gas more expensive, because manufacturers have to and refiners have to take special steps to make sure the gas qualifies. And then on top of all of that, he's proposing a cap and trade scheme, which would regulate how much carbon businesses and other industries can emit. And if they want to emit more, they'd have to pay a fee to do that. Well, again, the problem there is, you know, there's a couple problems. One is that we've emit China emits more carbon dioxide in a year than Washington emits in a week. So, you know, we are barely making the tiniest dent in the problem, even if this is successful. But more importantly, you know, in Washington, our biggest sources of carbon pollution are cars and agriculture and electricity and home heating, which means that the price of your gas, the price of your electricity and your heating your home and even your food is going to get more expensive. So the other side talks, rightly so, about the need to try to help families who work hard and struggle to make ends meet. The problem is so many of their policies don't align with that goal. And
I think they don't
want to be consistent.
Yeah, and the more people shine a spotlight on it, the better off we all will be. It starts, by the way, right now with backing the Real Recovery for Washington Act. We've been talking with State Representative Drew Stokesbury. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Again, that's House Bill 1334, the Real Recovery for Washington Act. Make sure you're getting in the ears of whomever represents you to make sure that they know you back this bill. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. Big Local when we come back.
Snoqualmie, Mercer Island, Des Moines.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Ranch Show.
Shoreline, Woodinville, Burien.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Yeah, okay, it's not 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. It's 4:48 on a weekday afternoon. But we can still do the Big Local brought to you by Alpine Specialty Cleaning at alpineclean.com. Why can't we do it wherever it is we want? Because I'm in charge. Leave me alone.
I mean, that's a fair point.
Come on.
If I were to pitch it, you'd probably say no. But since
I'd shoot that down in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Good job.
Okay. Let's start in the city of Auburn. Can we give a shout out to David Portnoy of Barstool Sports? Because he is doing more to help local small businesses here in Washington State than Governor Jay Inslee is. We brought you the story about, what, a month ago or so? Athens Pizza and Pasta out of Auburn, where, Peyton, you say this is the best pizza around.
Oh, it's so good. This is one of my favorite spots in Auburn.
They suffered a significant issue when part of their business burned down at the worst possible time because, like so many other restaurants, they are dealing with the COVID economy, with shutdowns thanks to Governor Jay Inslee, and they've been struggling to raise the money that they would need to reopen, to fix the problems with the fire, and then be able to reopen and successfully operate. Now, we had their owner, their co-owner, on the show about a month ago. She just got a call from Dave Portnoy, who created this Barstool Fund, which is going to help small businesses out there. He called and said, yeah, we're going to help you.
I'm glad you guys reached out. It's why we created the fund. So, yeah.
Great. So much for, FaceTiming us, calling us, choosing us. I can't believe this. I'm, in shock because I didn't even think anything was going to happen or come out of this.
No, well, we're glad to help, and we're pretty quick. So, after this is done, we'll get in touch with you. And we generally have, the funds within 72 hours. And each month, we'll just recheck in, make sure you guys are doing okay till, pandemic's over.
That is so, so amazing. Here he is explaining why he decided to even start the Barstool Fund.
I'm in New York. We relocated in New York, and they shut down indoor dining in New York City not too long ago. And we're like a media company, so I ranted. I didn't understand how they expected these people to survive because they weren't getting money and you weren't letting them. I mean, it's 10 degrees in New York, so outdoor dining is not really happening.
So
what do you expect these people to do? So I went on a rant and somebody just chirped at me. They're like, hey, Big Mouth, put your money where your mouth is. So I was like, you know what? They're right. And I'm passionate. So it took me 10 years with Barstool to make a profit. And if COVID hit, around then, we were out of business, and basically my adult life's work, everything I'd done would have been gone. With me, no say in it, no way to it's a hand you can't be dealt. So I felt awful about that, and we have this platform. So I put in money myself and then asked for our readers, and we have this big audience, and people just started donating. So the fund just kept growing and growing, and you guys aren't in Washington, we're on the East Coast. It's kind of spreading throughout the country. So it's been kind of beautiful.
This is a good man. who stepped up because our supposed leaders didn't want to. Governor Jay Inslee could help. He's choosing not to. We have folks like Drew Stokesbury, who we just had on, who's trying to help, but he needs to convince Democrats to get on board and allow funding to be offered to these businesses. You have John Braun and Ron Mazzol, Mark Mullett stepping up and trying to pass legislation that would at least immediately reopen restaurants at 25% capacity. Democrats right now are standing in the way. That's the only thing standing in the way. And so as some really strong Republican leaders are trying to push back against Democrats who have the power, are pushing back against the help, Dave Portnoy is stepping up and doing something. So kudos to him. With that said, Peyton, they did kind of cheat here.
Oh, how'd they cheat?
Because it was a fire that closed their business, not COVID.
Yeah, but imagine getting impacted by COVID and then your building catching on fire. It's not cheating. It's like getting kicked when you're already on the ground.
It's a little bit of cheating, but it's okay because it's a local business and I'm down to help.
And it's somewhere I adore. It's something. It's about Peyton here, okay?
I'm doing this for you.
Thank you.
I did send a note to Dave say, you might want to pull back some of that money. No, I'm kidding. Of course not. But speaking of restaurants, because Portnoy here is helping to keep businesses alive, keep restaurants alive, Inslee, of course, is trying to kill them. You've got Farm Boy Drive-In near Maytown. They owe $337,000 to the state of Washington in penalties because they stayed open through the pandemic, which was a choice that they made. And we put choice in air quotes because if they didn't, they would go out of business. If they didn't, their employees, their staff would suffer. So they decided to stay open. Same thing in Chehalis with Spiffy's. We talked about them before. They're now hit with fines totaling about $400,000 for violating the mandate to shut down indoor dining. Now, attorneys for the restaurants have previously argued that, hey, we're not forcing our employees to show up. They all signed waivers acknowledging the risks and saying that they are doing this because they want to, because they need to. And as a result, we should be able to remain open because of it. Now, judges so far in both of these cases said, nope. Sorry, it's not unconstitutional to close down your restaurants. They're trying to do what they can to survive. The state is doing what it can to shut them down. Still haven't seen any data suggesting these two restaurants are even tied to any COVID cases. The data we have seen shows that restaurants were not spreading the disease and that closing them down actually was responsible for the surge in COVID cases because people going to restaurants were following the rules and not spreading it, going into homes for private gatherings, not following rules, were spreading it. It's the Jason Rand Show live from D.C.